Welcome to All Road 65 Max Radio, where the road ahead gets brighter as we journey towards truth, traveling through our dreams and an inspiration into a new reality. It's time, and your ticket is waiting. All Roads Lead 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson.
Thank you for joining me on BBS Radio, All Roads 65 Max. I am your host, Pamela L. Henderson. My focus is my mission statement, to help create a quality of life through social growth, inspiring Jews to become leaders by establishing partnerships with entrepreneurs, corporations, donors, sponsors, volunteers, the community, and abroad. Please join me every other Tuesday at noon on BBS Radio. Also, subscribe to my other channel at Quora.com, Pamela L. Space. My special guest today is Mr. R.J. Stewart, who stated after two decades writing in Hollywood, he took two decades off. But even as the world has changed over time, the qualities and virtues that inspire us, particularly with resiliency, have not changed. And he thinks his novel reflects that spirit. At last, thank you for joining me on my channel, Mr. Stewart. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
How is it out there? So where are you from?
I'm originally from New York. Canarsie, I don't know if you know Brooklyn that well, but I'm from, I was born in the Quonset huts in Canarsie, and an older generation would know that right away. I think a lot of people don't remember the Quonset huts, but for those people who know the geography, it was at where Seaview crosses Rockaway. There was an area that had, they had erected Quonset huts for the GIs coming home from World War II. And, you know, they were like, you know, veteran housing. And so, you know, they're prefab housing, you know, nothing special. But I always tell people I was born in a Quonset hut. But, of course, I was born in a hospital and brought home to the Quonset hut, you know.
Right. So how's the weather out there? Is it cold? It is cold out here.
You know, we're at 4,000 feet. We're in the mountains on a ranch. And it was pretty nippy. I mean, nothing compared to what you guys got. But it was... You know, it got into the 30s last night, and it's probably, right now it's probably about 45.
Okay. We're here in California. Blue is bad out here. It is cold, and I just found out that I have allergies in my eyes, so.
Oh, my God.
Yes. I never thought I would have allergies. I was just bragging that, you know, I don't get sick, but yeah. Just the other day, I was driving, and then all of a sudden, I had to literally pull over because my eyes just start watering and itching. And so before I decided to start rubbing, I'm like, oh no, did it get me? And for sure enough, it did. So I got my tea, been trying to medicate a little bit and get rid of it.
I have a little bronchial thing going on. It's not too bad, but... Yeah, it's hard to stay healthy.
It is, isn't it? It is. It's like, if you think about it, all we do have to cleanse our liver and drink teas and do this and do that. You know, we don't have to, in a minute, we're not going to have to worry about losing no weight because we're going to be on some peanuts and raisins, far as I'm concerned. Well, we're going to get started here. I have a bunch of questions. You are a fascinating man. But my first question to you is, tell me, what was it like to be a Hollywood writer of popular films and TV shows for over 20 years?
Well, it was exciting, and there was a certain glamorous part to it, although certainly writers are stuck in an office, you know, chained to a desk. Not quite... and it's a lot of hard work, and that's for everybody. That's for everybody. So, you know, there's a lot of critiques of Hollywood, and some of it is justified. But one thing I always communicate as best as I can, Hollywood is about hard work. Everybody works really, really hard. And certainly I did that for 20 years. I was not out of work from 1980, 1 to 2003. So, there's always a downtime between projects and stuff, but I always kept going to the next project, so I was very proud of that. That's not that common in Hollywood.
I know, I bet, huh?
So I think that's one of the reasons I retired, because I think some people have these year offs where they're not getting work and then they get to work and stuff. But I just kind of relish the idea of spending some time, in retirement and doing what I wanted to do rather than what I had to do. Lawrence Kasdan said that being a screenwriter is like having homework for the rest of your life. And I chose for a while not to have homework, but I thought.
That's right.
But
That's right.
I decided the writing bug was still in me, and that's why I started working on a novel.
Okay. We all have a why to what brings us to, or we all have are inspired for what we do. So like me, I'm a mentor and I lead and train and develop, and I'm inspired of doing that because I feel that our girls need some guidance when it comes to self-discipline and also having some morals and integrity. So tell me about your inspiration for your story that came from your own real life eye opening of what you do, what you do.
The little backstory, storytelling came from my father. My father was a career military guy, sergeant in the Air Force, but he loved to tell stories. He used to tell me stories about Mickey Mouse and he knew I loved the Mickey Mouse characters, Goofy and those people, and he knew I loved the Charlie Brown characters. So he would intertwine the two characters together, like Snoopy would be chasing Mickey, and then Donald would bump into Schroeder, and Charlie Brown would be uniting them all. So he had a wonderful imagination. So I started writing very early. When I was 14, I started writing little short stories and stuff. And so writing had been in me a long time, and wanting to tell good stories and entertain people. Obviously, that's an important part. As far as what happened in our retirement that changed things, unfortunately, we had a couple of terrible losses. Two of our children died of cancer. Our son died of cancer in 2007, and our daughter died of cancer in 2018. So that focused me on expressing myself. And when I say that, I don't mean to say that this book is about cancer or death of young people in the prime of their life or that. There is death in the book because there's a lot of violence and stuff. But I felt that my wife and I got through it because we had strong interior lives. And that is a major theme in this book, is that interior, you have to have an interior life. If you're constantly just reacting to the outside forces, what happens when the outside forces become so harsh as to take your children? So you really have to have an interior fortress, is what Teresa of Avila calls it. There's a quote by the French philosopher, moralist, Champfort, which is, happiness is very difficult to find in ourselves and impossible to find anywhere else. And so I definitely felt that that was something I wanted to express. And the main character in the book, Deirdre, is someone who battles through. Her sister is kidnapped early in the book, and she's on the trace of the kidnappers, and she depends on her interior fortress quite a bit to get through, as do other characters in the book.
Yeah, that was my next question. So I was going to ask you about the book. It's very interesting, and how the main character Deidre, who was fueled by hate for her sister's kidnappers, was able to find romantic love. Tell me about that.
And she's almost distracted from her mission by this falling meeting this guy, Jube. She meets him on the trail, and he at first he's useful to her. So he's, you know, her discipline had been, you know, she rides a horse. I'm a big horseman, and my horse, who died in 2021, I had for 20 years and put thousands of hours on him. His name was Danny, and the horse in the book is named Danny also. And you know, she's fine with being on the trail with just her horse because she's a very formidable woman. She can take care of herself. And she meets this guy, Jube, who's an itinerant photographer. And he's very gentle and kind and loving and kind of, you know, she's not in that mood right now. You know, she's in the revenge, vengeful mood, but she's so
Right.
attracted to that and so attracted to that side of him that they have a relationship, fall in love. They work together to save some kids, not her sister. They haven't got her sister back yet, to save some kids from these kidnappers. And then she falls in love with him and she finds herself, her resolve softening a bit. And at what point of the book, I'm getting an audio book made, and I just listened to those scenes read today, and it's really works great. She reaches a point where she has to be harsh with Jube, which she hates because she loves the guy. But she tells herself, you know, I can't. You know, she says to Jube, "I'll die for you. I'll kill for you. I'll walk barefoot in the snow for you, but there's one thing I won't do for you. I won't give up on my sister," because Jude wants her to, you know, not go into danger again, but she's got to do it. And so that's one of the conflicts of it. And they're separated for a while, and will they get back together? And, you know, so
Right.
that's one of the themes of the book also, a love story.
Yeah, it is. Wow. And the story about Crazy Hawk, the strong female who had a lot of fight in the rescue and revenge mission. Tell me about that.
Well, she's crazy. Deirdre is Crazy Hawk. And the reason she's called Crazy Hawk is that her tribe is rivals with this is a post-apocalyptic world, you know, a hundred years
Right.
later, a lot of what we call technology is gone. They ride horses. There is some technology that people, individuals revive. For instance, Jube has revived photography, you know, so there is a little technology from our world that pops up into their lives. But the what Deirdre is a part of a tribe called the Hussars, and there's another tribe called the Nations, and the Nations are indigenous people like the Hopi Nations, the Apache Nation, the Navajo Nation, and they have a rivalry with the Hussars, the character, the tribe she belongs to. And the Hussars have a ranking system. The highest ranking Hussar is called the Eagle. The next one is called the Falcon. And you go down, they're all raptors. And the next one is the Hawk. So her rank is the Hawk. And so the Nations give her a nickname, Crazy Hawk, because she's such a fierce warrior. They call her Crazy Hawk, and that's her nickname. And that gets around. A lot of people call her Crazy Hawk for that reason.
Okay. In your opinion, you say that America at times feels like it is at a breaking point.
Right.
You address those fears and passions when drawing the world in your book, and I found that to be fascinating. The future is not yet determined, but for some, it can seem a dark, violent place. Why would you say that?
Well, I live out in rural San Diego County, and I'm surrounded by different factions. You know, there's plenty of liberals here. You know, they're very identifiable with the liberals I worked with for years in Hollywood. And there's also conservatives. Not all of them are Trumpites, but there is a contingent of Trumpites. And when I speak to them, the passion they have on these two islands seems irreconcilable. You know, it seems that way. In the book, however, I offer some hope. And in the, well, I don't want to tell you the ending, but I think there's some hope about, people who are really disparate and hopelessly separated by passionate feelings, coming together for a common cause. And I hope that's somewhere in the future, because it's not there right now.
Yeah, I tell you, we're going through a lot of changes, aren't we? So, how the son of a U.S. Air Force sergeant grew up in six states and experienced three other nations. Now, I was like, when I read that, as you see, I was doing a little research about you, and I was like, my God, what is it that you really have not explored? So tell me about that. I know that was.
When I said experience three nations, what I meant was my dad was stationing in Greece for 3 years in the Isle of Crete. So that was a wonderful experience. But even though he was a mere sergeant, he was given a vacation every year somewhere in Europe. And 1 year he went to Italy, and 1 year he went to Germany, and of course took us with him. And so so that's what I mean, experiencing those three nations.
Okay.
As a child, I was 12, 13, and 14 going through that experience. I think I'd actually turned 15 just when I got back to the States. But that was so enriching, and I really think it formed me in a way that it was just, when I was going through it, there wasn't totally positive. Sometimes I felt isolated, and it's not always fun to be in a foreign country, but it was so stimulating and interesting. I was a very curious kid. I read books, and I got so into the Minoan culture, and but I was reading Nikos Kazantzakis when I was 13 years old. I gotta admit that I would rather read Alastair MacLean, the adventure writer, but I w but because of the house we lived in Heraklion, there was a wall, an old Venetian wall, and I could walk to a plaque honoring Nikos Kazantzakis. I said recently in another interview that he was buried in the wall, but then I thought about it and I said, I don't think he was buried there. It was just a plaque commemorating him. And he wrote Zorba the Greek and many other classic novels. And so it was a really enriching time for me. And I can't imagine who I'd be without that experience.
I think we get the best experience at a young age, and we travel with our parents because at that time they're trying to find themselves too and what's best for the family and to move forward and everything. And but I didn't travel like that. I think, I spent a lot of time like at different lakes and little vacations and things like that. I didn't see the world when I was young. But excuse me,
Well,
as I got older.
it's an interesting thing to be. This is an observation I made really in high school, that being a child of a parent who gets transferred a lot to different locations and doesn't have really any say so over it, is a complicated thing. If you have a happy home life, I think it's very manageable because the happiness goes with you.
True.
People I felt real bad for were the people that had an unhappy home, and they would make their friends would be their whole life, and then suddenly they have to move to another location, they have to start all over again, and they don't like their home. There were a couple of really ugly situations where the father would be abusive, or violent, abusive, that kind of thing. I'm not going to say his last name, but one friend of mine, Ronnie, got beat up all the time by his dad, but he was really pretty happy where we were living, and because he had so many friends, and then he got word that they were moving out west to Arizona. His father got stationed at Luke Air Force Base, and I could tell he was really sad because he had to leave his friends and go with this family that was totally dysfunctional and a mess. But if you might have read into that, I had great parents, so I you know they neither one of them graduated from high school, and like I said, my dad was a sergeant, and the Air Force is definitely there's definitely a hierarchy. There's the officers and pilots, and they, you know, they go to the officers club, and then there's the non-commissioned officers, which my dad was, and they go to the NCO club. It's called the non-commissioned officers club. And so I think the quality of parenting they did was a very sophisticated quality. I don't know where they learned it from. I know my father felt he had an abusive home growing up, so he was determined to reverse that trend. And my mother, I think, had a very nurturing home, but her mother died when she was 13, so she had a lot of insecurities. So and they both grew up in the Depression, you know, so where everybody was poor, you know, so there was a
Right.
was that period. And so I think they just formed this nice little family unit. That you know, I wouldn't say my, you know, this is an interesting thing. I think it has more to do with me rather than the family. You know, people say, did you have a happy childhood? And I think about it sometimes. I can't remember like thinking happy, like hey, everything's great. But there were traumas, and moving to new locations scared the crap out of me. I'm not trying to make light of that,
Right.
but I had a secure feeling childhood. How's that? That's the best way to feel. Because the worst thing a child can go through
Change.
is change and insecurity. You know, we have nine grandchildren, and you know, we've lost two of our children to cancer. So
Wow.
we've watched grandchildren lose their parent, you see, and that's rough to watch.
Yes. Sorry to hear that. Yes, it is totally.
Yeah, and so the you know that we had that security is one of the reasons that I probably did have a happy childhood. I you know my father we were big Giant fans, San Francisco, well, New York Giants. We were born into we were close to the Polo Grounds. We used to go to the Polo Grounds all the time in New York and watch Willie Mays. Willie Mays was my childhood idol, and then they moved to San Francisco. And all my Giant fan friends in New York were like suicidal, you know, like the Giants left, you know. Do we have to be Yankee fans now? Because the Dodgers left at the same time, you know. So
Okay.
yeah, so they only had one choice is the Yankees. They hated the Yankees, of course. And the but I have no problem with it because we moved around so much. My allegiance can switch to California. I don't have any problem. And one of the
Right.
things we got stationed in Phoenix, Arizona, where the Giants did their spring training, and we would go to watch Willie. I would sit down on the you know back in those days there were no snowbirds or anything. Hardly anybody went to spring training in those days. It's hard to believe today because it's a big thing today, but hardly anybody was there. So we always could get a ticket if we drove out. They were cheap. And I'd sit on the third baseline right close, and I was so sure. My dad said, "Say something to Willie. Say something to him. You know, he'll probably talk you up." I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. It was just, you
You
know,
just froze up,
yeah, I just froze up. And
huh?
but I did talk to Hank Thompson, who was another African American player on that team. And I chose him particularly because I was hoping maybe, you know, this might be my access into Willie. But anyway,
Yeah.
few good conversations with Hank, but not never, you know, Willie would always be friendly looking and smile and wave and stuff. So, because I would wave constantly at him, you know.
Right, huh? You can't miss me, hey.
So that was a huge bond between my father and I. That
Okay.
was my mother was very religious, and I was very, very religious as a child. However, I wasn't that religious as an adult. And that was a problem with my mother and I. She was very disappointed in that.
Okay.
I'm more religious now, so we probably would have had more of a connection now. She passed in 2001.
Well, what made you more religious now?
Going through the death of children and stuff, you start
Okay.
looking, you know, like I said, that interior castle thing you need to have. Jesus is a good place to get that interior castle from.
Absolutely. I do agree. You had said the importance of the interior life is highlighted in the story, which made it very interesting as well. In part because of the fortitude when you and your wife needed to survive the loss of your two children to cancer. And I know that you have elaborated on that, but can you elaborate a little bit more? Because that was very, very heartfelt for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, there is no, in my case in particular, I think what a saving thing for me, other than the spiritual and religious readings and philosophical readings I did, and also prayer, and also just working on my interior life. The other thing that helped save me was, it was so devastating to my wife. I could see it just so devastating to my wife. And I was able to just assign myself as this is time to take care of her. You know, she's taken care of you so often in your life, and this is your mission now, to take care of her. And I'm not saying I was perfect at it. I had horses. I like to go off riding a lot because I did do an escapist thing, particularly after our son died. I did a lot of escapist riding. I'd be out on the trail for hours on end. But when I could, I really, and you know what she did? She saw that the grandchildren needed her, you know, because they, you know, one set of grandchildren lost their father and another grandchild lost their mother. So she just threw herself into that world and with such heroism. So that's how she got through it. So I think loving and giving is the best way to get through a tragedy. Not easy by any means. Also, I you know, to be lighter, I do think escape is important too. To you know, I don't think you can just sit there with it nonstop. You have to have some escape, and it can be as easy as going to a ball game, or but as complicated as taking a trip to Europe or something, you know. But you have to have some escape. You don't have to feel guilty about the escape because it'll come back. It's not like your escape will you know, now I don't care anymore. I got children now. They'll care. By the time you get back, or even when you're on the trip, it's impossible to think. But you know, there is a cycle. I'm talking on a total surface way down. There is a
That's
sort
okay.
of psychological benefit of being in a different place. You know, different things are, you know, when you walk around the house and you see pictures of your kids all over the place, you know, it's hard to shake it. But when you're in a great museum in Italy, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I do agree. Because my mom was my best friend, and I lost her in 2011 to cancer. And all I was, I mean, just in my mind, all I could think about is all the good times that we were going, because she didn't want to have that trachea in her throat. She had carcinoma cancer. So she could have lived longer, but she was like, she didn't want to be a robot. She's like, I'm going to sound like a robot. I don't
Quality of
want to
life.
do that.
Totally understand it. Totally understand it.
Absolutely. And so we made the best of it and we just had so much fun. But losing her, I lost part of myself too, because I had gotten real quiet and, you know, that's my best friend. That's all I had. That was the person I went to when I had money problems. You know, and I had issues or obstacles, and she just had great advice. And really, if I when I come to think about it, my mom was the person who inspired me to be an entrepreneur and a leader. And those are the things that help me to keep going when I get a little down, especially around Mother's Day, because she passed away the day before Mother's Day. And I have to do things to leave, like you said, to get that other balance where you can, you know, feel good just with the memory. But when I do think about it, and if I need to go and talk with her, I go to the grave, take some flowers, you know.
Yeah, the our son is interred in Los Angeles. Our daughter is interred in Florida, Central Florida, Orlando area, and so we don't get to her grave very much. But February 9th is our son's passing, and
Oh, screen.
we will go up in there and you know do that, visit the grave, and take some of the grandchildren with us.
Oh, yeah.
He was a busy guy. He left seven children.
Wow.
Two
Okay.
marriages. Two marriages, seven
Oh,
children.
two marriages. Yeah. Okay.
He started
Okay.
young. He started young.
That's right. He had a beautiful soul because my birthday is February the 12th. I'm around Valentine's Day.
Yeah,
So
that's
I'm still celebrating that I am.
the and I don't really don't want to make this a special thing about Chris, but Chris was just loved his kids. He just adored his kids. Most people love their kids, so I mean, I don't want to make
Yeah.
it was uniquely, but I know they lost a lot when he went. But the kids lost a lot.
Absolutely. God bless him. God bless you too.
Thank you.
Well, getting back to the book, you said Crazy Hawk treats readers to glimpses and warnings, not just of a possible future, but to an understanding of one woman's inner determination and drive to fight for what she believes in. Tell me a little bit more about that, because that
Well,
is true.
that's one thing that I like best of what I did is that what she believes in the beginning is not identical to what she believes in the end. Because
Okay.
in the beginning, she's part of this tribe, and their ethos is basically whatever's good for the tribe is good. And
Okay.
whatever threatens the tribe is bad. But her relationship with Jube has taught her to be more universalist, reach out to more people, care about other peoples. And the fact that she needed to enlist the aid of people who she had thought of as enemies in order to fight a common enemy it leads her to be a much more dedicated person, someone dedicated to peace and united people rather than the diversity the I mean, diversity is a good thing if people get along. Diversity starts to get bad if everybody's fighting each other.
Right.
So that's how she evolves. She doesn't see herself as quite as much as just a Hussar. That's the name of her tribe. She's not just a Hussar. She is a human being who has to get along with. She's a citizen of that area, Southern California, Arizona area. So she's the one of the. The things at the end is that the traditional. Well, I'm giving now. Now I'm giving away too much. So, let's.
So how did you come up with that title of the book, and Deidre? How did she get that character, a woman?
Well, the character I would say is a blend of several people I've known through my life. Certainly in Hollywood, you meet a lot of. Formidable women, that's a place that really has writers and actresses and who are really solid. Of course, I wrote Xena Warrior Princess, which I was skilled at using a strong woman in a dramatic way. And by the way, I went to a Xena convention a couple of weeks ago and met all these Xena fans, lovely people. I probably should go to more of them, but they were it was very nice to see them. And the visual of her changed different. At first I had her blonde. I don't know why I just chose that. You're typing and you say blonde. But then as I started thinking her more and more, the most of this coincidentally. I mean, I've known many admirable blonde women, but most of the women that I in my life who had that kind of grit happen to be brunettes. So I know it's a fairly shallow thing, but you want to visualize someone you as the writer can believe in. So I started morphing her into that. And that wasn't a big deal. You just go back and change the word blonde to brunette. But I fell in love with her during the writing of the book. I mean, I really think she's a well-rounded character and getting a lot of good feedback on that character from people, and that's nice.
Wow, yeah. So let's talk about your accolades. You made an explosive debut as a novelist. You are not new to the writing, however, your 22-year Hollywood writing career, punctuated by your work for the groundbreaking television show Xena, Princess Warrior, and I like that name. That includes collaborating with multi-generational talents such as Kevin Costner, James Gardner, Charlie Sheen, Pierce Brosnan. Tell me about that. That's interesting.
Well, somebody asked me recently in one of these interviews is, what did I learn from Pierce? And the thing I that was my first job. I came on, I was a Teamster. I was driving for a living. And then they read a script I wrote. The people at Clem Karen, who worked for who was the supervising producer on Remington, read a script I wrote and then hired me on as a story editor on the TV show. It was my first, literally my first job in Hollywood. And I used to go down, excuse me, I was assigned because they didn't have enough office space on the same floor as where the other Remington offices were. I was assigned a dressing room down, we're close to where the actors would be. So Pierce would just sashay in all the time and chat me up. He loved my wife. He loved Kat. He loved to come flirt with Kat. Kat's very Irish. He's very Irish. They hit it off great. And I thought, here he is exploding. I was watching him that first year of Remington become a star, And yet he was so relaxed. Now, who knows what, when he got home, he might have been, had anxiety and stuff. I'm not saying he was totally free of any kind of pressure, but he seemed to be enjoying it so much. And it was a lesson for me that go ahead and smell those flowers, we all are afraid the flowers will disappear, and that's why we work harder and
Right.
but while they're there, you should do it. I thought that's what I learned from Pierce, is that smell the flowers. They might get you high,
That's right. See, that was my next question, because I was going to ask you, what did you learn from working with, what about The Rock and Lucy Lawless,
Well,
Kevin Costner?
Lucy Lawless, who I just saw a few days ago at the convention, is just a
Okay.
wonderful person, lovely, a kind and hardworking, but very strong. She takes care of herself. There's nothing weak or better. But she is. I learned from her that you can deal with pressure and fame and fortune and still be kind and generous and giving. And that's what I learned from Lucy. Who else? Who else did you ask about?
Kevin
Oh, The Rock.
Costner.
Michael Costner. He is so intense and creative. I was just a little disappointed. That was I'm going to hold off telling you what movie it was. I was working on a major movie with him, and
Okay.
there was sort of a conflict between him and the director, and I got kind of stuck in between them, and I unfortunately wasn't able to finish the project. That means they fired me at a certain point, but I really enjoy working with Kevin because he was so passionate about it. I mean, he took it so seriously. Making up stories for him is just, you can tell he just loves it. And so do I. So we had a I had a real good relationship with Kevin. So that was very disappointing that didn't work out.
What about The Rock?
The Rock is the most disciplined guy I've ever been around. He
Really?
yeah, I would say, I don't know how much I learned from that because I don't think I'm very disciplined, but I mean, physically disciplined, what he drinks, what he, you know, what he, you know, how he conducts his life, how often he
Right.
works and stuff. And yeah, so that I learned the opposite thing from Charlie Sheen, of course, when I worked with Charlie. Basically, the simplest way I can describe Charlie is that he's a guy who doesn't understand the value of a good night's sleep.
No. What about James Gardner?
James Gardner was so hardworking and humble, but tough. He was a tough guy. I mean, not to be confused with, I mean, there's l the legends of his kindness to the little people and stuff. That's very much true. But he was also a tough guy. If he didn't put up with much bullshit. And
Oh, see. Yeah, I
I
see that.
appreciate that. I appreciate that.
And last but least, what about Rebecca De Mornay?
Rebecca De Mornay, beautiful. The one experience I remember with her is she invited me over to her. I think she was staying at the Hotel Marmont or whatever it's called, And she invited me over to run lines with her, right? We were supposed to act it out. And it was fascinating to see my dialogue be interpreted on the spot by this wonderful actress, and the exchange there. She's another one who's very dedicated, very passionate about her work.
Yeah, I can see that. Tell me about the other books that you have. You have written other books, right? Other novels?
No, this is my first one. I'm working on a
Oh, is
sequel.
it?
Yeah. This is my first one.
Okay. And it has taken off, doing well, and
It is
all
doing
that
well
other good stuff.
for a yeah. It's doing well, and I'm very pleased with it. And reviews have been excellent. I was just rereading. You go back and reread your reviews when they're good. When they're bad,
That
you
keeps you
hide
together. That keeps
them.
you motivated. Oh, is that what they said? Okay,
I
so.
was looking back at the Kirkus Review and the Publishers Weekly's Book Life Review, and I was saying, I did something right here. That was and several of them bring up the fact that this is my first novel. It's unusual for somebody to hit it so well as on their first novel.
Yeah, that is true. I have written a book too. My
Okay.
book is called A Journey of a Sapphire.
Okay.
And it is about a young girl whom was on her journey towards success and was taken off that road due to the challenges and obstacles that had affected her journey. And it became a fight. But at the end, what I teach, or I'm trying to make a point to inspire other girls of all ages, is to never give up on your dreams and aspirations. Because during this journey, I did have accolades as well, with the UN, Queen Elizabeth acknowledgement,
Oh,
and
that's great.
establishing my foundation where I give back to girls 14 to 24 years old. And I teach and help build customer service skills because that is what is important. Everything we do, we conversate and we talk, and it's knowing how to deal with anger, obstacles, and not letting anyone take you off that road.
That
Off
is,
that road.
yeah. I mean, sometimes the obstacles seem pretty overwhelming, and sometimes that anger gets going. But anger, in the sequel of my to this book, I want to start it off with this famous quote from the New Testament. It's you've heard that you should hate your enemies, but I say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Lord Jesus Christ. Now, that's not a big religious theme in the book, but I want to make it clear that yeah, there's a revenge theme in this, but is it the revenge appropriate? Is revenge appropriate? Is anger appropriate? Sometimes you got to forgive to save yourself.
That is so true, because on this journey that I was on, and all the attacks and being persecuted and actually misjudged, because in my book I discuss about still trying to stay on my journey, taking care of my mom who had cancer, bedridden, and also fighting for my grandson who I have today, who's doing very, very well. And at this time, back in 2009, there was limited resources for girls whom had their children removed from their home, such as my daughter, due to domestic violence. And my background is hospitality. And so when I seen this and was on this journey with her, I knew God just knocked on me and he said, you need to help bring awareness to certain issues. And that is what I did. And so I had established my foundation, and I am totally global, and I love what I do on site or online. And also, I became an award-winning author of my book as well. And I'm hoping one day my book will become a true live movie as well, because it's really, really deep and all the things that I
What's
have
the name
gone
of it?
through.
What's the name of it?
A Journey of a Sapphire.
A Journey of a Sapphire. I love that.
Thank you. And the one thing that bringing to what you just said about how you get over and to accept things, I didn't know that I was carrying a lot of anger within. So I was thinking that me just being strong and, oh, I'm still going to do this and do that, I didn't know how deep I was wounded inside. And just one day, I just broke down and just was crying, and I didn't understand why I was so emotional. But then something lifted off of my back, and I just felt so much better. And I think it was just me making that statement to myself that you're okay, Pamela, and you just forgive those who didn't understand you and move forward. And here I am. I feel
That's
really
great.
good now.
That's wonderful. I'm sure
Yes,
you
sir.
give excellent mentoring.
Yes, sir. That I do. And my story itself does bring, light to other young women, because the girls that I mentor are girls of domestic violence, transitioning to foster care, trafficked, having family problems, truant, and veterans. And that group itself, to give them the platform and to be that mentor to say, you're not by yourselves. This is what happened to me and how I moved forward, and here I am. And it brings good results. So I do like that.
Sounds great. That sounds very inspirational.
I didn't ask you this question, which I'm going to ask you now, because when I was reading about you, tell me, how did your family roots in America date back to the 1830s?
1830s, yeah. My English, I'm basically a British Isle mutt, like Irish, Scottish, English with a little German in there.
A little bit all, everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the English side of the family, the Herrings, came over in 1832, and they settled in New York. And the movie Gangs of New York?
Yes.
They settled right in that area. And he
Okay.
was that. Wait a minute. He was a butcher. He remember in the movie Bill the
Yeah.
Butcher? Well, ever since that movie came out, I always called this great great grandfather of mine Bob the Butcher. Now, I went to the address in the Lower East Side where he used to work, and it's still a meat processing place, a slaughterhouse. Or they're slaughtered elsewhere, but they're processed
Right.
there. And so, when he said he was a butcher, he didn't mean he had his own butcher shop. He was working in a big meat processing place. And I would imagine in the 1830s, that was a rough day of work. And he evolved out of that and started working as a streetcar conductor, which I'm sure was a big step forward at that time. And so that was my English relatives, one side of it. The other side, Hauptmann, the Hauptmanns came out over the 1860s, and he had worked the Hauptmann is German, but they came from England, so he must have migrated to his father, I think, migrated to England, and then he migrated to America. But his he was a he came from an area of the Czech Republic, which is Czech Republic now. In those days, it called it Bohemia. It was part of the Austrian Empire. But he worked at a in this area of he came from this area of Czech Republic that is famous for glass cutting to this day, and that is what he did in New York for a while. And then my Irish relatives came over in the 1870s. They were a little come lately, and they worked as a my Uncle Willie worked as a in the census. He says he was a lorry driver, which of course in that day would have been horses. He's driving horses to deliver stuff. And my grandfather said he worked as a groom. And what I learned by my research is what they usually had is they usually had two people on these delivery things, because you can't have runaway horses while you're up delivering the ice. So One guy would go in to make the delivery. This was an ice company. They would be delivering big chunks of ice. One guy would go in, the other guy would stay out with the horses or the horse. I think it was one horse. And my father said that by the time he was around, his father, they had him late. He was the last child of a big family. And his father was pretty old when he was driving around in the truck. And by then, his father had been driving a gas truck. But there were still horses in, this is the 1920s, there were still horses in New York. And my grandfather was passionate about making sure nobody was abusing or overworking the horses. And he would jump out of the truck and yell at people and say, "You can't do that." So anyway, it's a nice thing. When I got into horses, my father, who was not into horses, said, "Yeah, your grandpa would have appreciated that."
Well, I know we're up for time, but is there anything else you would like to share about the book and how someone can purchase the book?
Yeah, the book's available on Amazon. And I had just pulled it out a few other places so that I can go exclusive on Amazon. I don't know if you know what Kindle Unlimited is,
Yeah, I have Kindle.
I'm going to put it in Kindle Unlimited, and you need to be exclusive with Amazon to do that. I'm not doomed for that. It's only a 3 month period, and we'll see what happens. So you can get it within a week or so. It'll be on Kindle Unlimited, and an audiobook is coming out in mid-March. I was just talking today about whether I wanted to do a pre-sale or just go directly to sale, and I haven't decided yet. But it was certain either the pre-sale will start in mid-March or the book will be up. And if I do a pre-sale, I'll probably put the sale date like in May 1st or something like that. I need to talk to marketing people to determine, what's best. I mean, I have no idea.
We'd be like, just let's put it out and everything. So yeah, we do need their input. Well, Mr. Stewart, it has been a pleasure having you on my
I had a
show.
great time. I really appreciate it, Pamela. You're
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
very good at this, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I've been with BBS Radio for 3, 4 years now.
Great.
And I
What does
love what
BBS
I do.
stand for? What does BBS stand for?
BBS Radio?
What does the BBS stand for?
What is that? Broadcast
Okay, one of those things.
something, something.
I used to know when I was a kid. I thought it was important to know what that was.
It is. I got to ask
ABC,
Doug again.
NBC, PBS, but I'd forgotten totally what those things stand for.
I'll find out and get back with you on
Okay, not terribly important. But
Well,
anyway,
readers,
I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
well, thank you so much. Hopefully you come back.
Oh, I would love that.
Come back, come back.
Okay.
Well, readers, I have reached my destination. As always, I leave you with this quote. There are no secrets. There are only varied ways of sharing reality and truth. R.J. Stewart. Until next time, have a beautiful day and God bless.
Thank you for listening to All Roads 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson. Join us every other week on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio Station 1. And please visit allroads65max.org and become a volunteer or sponsor and be the change you want to see in this world. With your help, we can make a difference in our society and uplift those who so desperately need our help. Thank you for tuning in.